Hi, everyone. Welcome to the January 12, 2015 Florida Bar Construction Law Committee meeting. We'll start off with recognizing our officers. I'm Hardy Roberts, the chair. Our vice chair is Scott Pence. Lee Weintraub is also vice chair, and Robert Jones is our secretary. As usual, we are recording our meeting for our podcast, as well as we will record our CLE today, presented by Elizabeth Ryan on electronic discovery. So you all should have gotten an email circulated with the minutes. Can I get a motion to approve the minutes from our December meeting?
So moved.
Second?
Second.
Anybody want to discuss it? All right, with that, as usual, we'll approve our minutes and continue forward. So you should have an agenda. We'll work through that in order with one exception. We're going to take the Construction Litigation Subcommittee's report out of order and do that first. Neil Sivier is the chair of our recently formed Construction Litigation Subcommittee. Neil, are you there?
I am. Thank you for taking me out of order.
Sure thing. Go right ahead.
We have had one telephonic meeting. The first thing on the agenda for our committee is to set up a seminar for probably this year, perhaps even early next year. I've sort of been directed by everybody that a webcast-type seminar would be favored, and I'm working my way through the politically proper way of setting this up through the real property probate and trust law section with Hardy's help, and also with the help of Lee Weintraub and others who have had more experience. We have a second telephonic meeting set up on the 28th, which I've notified everybody about, and hopefully by next month's meeting we'll have a little bit more firmed up in terms of setting that up. But that's our status right now.
All right, sounds good. Everyone, if you want to get involved in our Construction Litigation Subcommittee, email Neil Sivier, and he'll add you to the ranks in his list. And it's on our radar to, once we find out when all the subcommittees are meeting, put out a calendar so everyone's got the info. Before we go on, let me note something a little odd. It turns out that for a year we have been using another subcommittee's call-in and PIN. At least that's what I've been told, so that we've just lucked out that we haven't conflicted. I don't know if that's true or what happened, but you'll note in the agenda there is going to be a new call, well, same call-in number, but a different PIN for our February meeting. And I'll send all this to you all in an email and a calendar invite and send a lot of reminders to make sure we all end up on the right call next month. But if you know folks you usually attend that you talk to, let them know, because that'll be an interesting switch to make. With that, we'll move forward. Next is we'll hear from our ABA Forum liaison, Carrie Wright.
Hey, Hardy, good afternoon. The upcoming meetings for the ABA, the midwinter meeting is in a couple of weeks, January 29th through the 30th in Scottsdale. It's going to be a great meeting. It's titled My Favorite Mistakes, What Doesn't Bankrupt You Makes You Stronger. They expect a great turnout. I spoke to Steve Lesser this morning, and there are 5 rooms available left at the hotel. So if you are able to attend and want to, I encourage you to register quickly and get the reservation in the hotel. That is Super Bowl weekend in Phoenix in the Scottsdale area, so there will be a lot of people there, so the rooms will be at a premium. It's also the same weekend as the Scottsdale Open, which is a fantastic golf tournament if you're interested in golf. The next program on the list is the Sticks and Bricks regional meeting, and we're actually having one in Fort Lauderdale at the Becker and Polikoff's office. If you're a young lawyer or even an older lawyer that wants to get a great primer on the process of building buildings and whatnot, that's always been a fantastic program. And again, that is February 27th. And for Florida attorneys, it's going to be in Fort Lauderdale. And then the annual meeting for the forum is also going to be in the Fort Lauderdale area at the Boca Raton Resort and Club, April 16th through the 18th. And so this is a great time, if you're not involved in the forum, to get involved. Also, the ABA is running a special now that if you're not an ABA member, you can get a free membership. And I think, Hardy, you may have circulated the ad to the Construction Law Committee. If not, we can have that circulated. But if you join now, you'll have free membership until the next bar year, which is August the 31st. So again, great time to get involved. Steve Lesser is the chair of the forum. You know, it's 13 divisions, and if you want to get involved in any of those divisions, just give me or Steve a call, and we'll get you plugged into to the right people. And then the fall meeting is going to be October 8th and 9th in Austin, and then next year's winter meeting is in January 20th through the 21st in San Francisco. And that's my report.
Very good. Thanks a lot, Kerry. Anybody, any questions for Kerry? All right, we'll keep moving. Next, Deborah Mastin is the chair of our ADR subcommittee. Deb, anything to add today? Deb, I don't think, is here. So we'll keep moving. Fred Dudley, who chairs the certification exam committee for board certification for construction lawyers. So we'll give us a liaison of sorts report, Fred.
Fred's not here. This is Steve Sellers.
And, hey, Steve.
Hey, he won't have a report for that today.
No worries. Thanks for letting me know. Brian Rizzio, are you here with any update on the construction review course?
Yeah, I sure am, Hardy. We're set to go. We've got the materials from probably about 95% of our speakers. We're going to track down a couple more materials this week, get that to the Florida Bar. The registration is live on the Florida Bar website, so we're moving along.
Very good. Thanks, Brian. And related to that is the Construction Law Institute, the Grand Ball. Reese, are you here? Want to give us an update?
I am, Hardy. And the 8th Annual Construction Law Institute will be March 12th through 14th at the JW Marriott Orlando Grand Lakes in Orlando, Florida. And, of course, that's being held in conjunction with the Construction Law Certification Review course. The review course, of course, starts on that Thursday and goes through Saturday. The Institute starts on Friday and concludes on Saturday. But on Thursday, those of you who are attending the Institute can golf instead of attending class. The JW Marriott Orlando Grand Lakes has a beautiful golf course. We should be forwarding to you, Hardy, in the next week or so, some additional information about that golf course to distribute to the listserv for folks to see what the course is like and generate some interest. And I'd invite those who are planning to golf to forward an email to me because we're going to be wanting to reach out to folks and start compiling lists of foursomes and that sort of thing. So let us know who you are. We can get that through the bar, but it can sometimes be cumbersome to get that information. We are looking for, we have a very strong sponsorship again this year. My vice chair, Jason Quintero, has once again done a fabulous job generating sponsorship interest, and the industry sponsors are coming out in force as always. We're still looking for a few more law firm sponsors, so anybody interested in being a sponsor, you get two free admissions, or two admissions are included to the Institute and all of its associated social events with a purchase of a law firm sponsorship. And that's by over $1,000 value. And so we invite, those we've had firm sponsor in the past that have stepped up to the plate, but anybody whose firm might be, if you're interested in planning to attend anyway, this is a great way to raise your visibility inside of the Construction Law Committee. So let us know if you're interested and contact either myself or Jason Quintero. A couple other things to note. As Brian noted, registration is live on the BARS website as well as the Reptile Section's website. You can go either place. Under the BARS website, it's under the CLE Committee tab. Under the Reptile Section, it's under the Construction Law Institute Committee window. The room rate block is available until February 20th, so anybody wanting to lock in their room rate at the group rate, those rooms will go fast, so make sure you get in your book your room quickly. Finally, I wanted to just let everybody know that we have, since the very first Institute, awarded an annual Lifetime Achievement Award, and we'll be doing that again this year. But this year, we're going to add a second award known as the Rising Star Award, where we're going to recognize a younger attorney who has contributed substantially to the Institute or the committee and shows great promise for the future. We want to recognize not just the longer in tooth members of our committee, but also those who are doing yeoman's work as younger attorneys. So that concludes my report, Hardy.
Excellent, Reese. Thanks a lot. Anybody, any questions about the Institute? All right, we'll keep going. Next up is our Construction Regulation Subcommittee, headed by Fred Dudley and Steve Sellers. I know Steve's here with us. Steve, I think you do have a report from us, and we've circulated the written report, which we appreciate very much.
Okay, good. I only have one case to talk about, and then all of Fred's notes are included in the written materials. This is a case that was just released January the 7th, 2015. It's McIntosh versus Progressive Design and Engineering. It's out of the 4th DCA. This is another case applying the Slavin Doctrine and applying it to an engineering firm. There was an engineering firm that was a subcontractor to a design contractor to DOT, hired to design the signaling for an intersection in South Florida. And they designed it in a defective manner, and shortly after the project was constructed, a man exiting apparently went through the light and was hit by a truck and killed, and his estate filed a lawsuit against DOT and pretty much everyone else involved in the project, and including this design engineer. And the jury was instructed on the Slavin Doctrine, and the trial court and the appellate court found that Slavin Doctrine does apply to an engineering company providing engineering services on a project, and that there was sufficient evidence of acceptance and that the defect was a patent defect. If you recall, the Slavin Doctrine related to a plumber installing a sink on a wall that came loose and injured a guest in a motel. Actual work. In this case, it's interesting to me, but this is not the first time that the doctrine has been applied to an engineer who is considered an expert with an undergraduate degree and licensing and all that type of thing. And so it seems to me an odd thing to apply the Slavin Doctrine to an engineer, to a professional, for their design work. But here the court had no problem, and apparently there was precedent for it, including a case that I spoke about a couple of months ago. The interesting thing was the issue of acceptance, whether the owner accepted or not. And the design work was actually accepted months and months and months before the project was ever constructed. And the court talked about the issue of acceptance has to do with who has control over the work at that time. And it talks about this concept that acceptance is kind of a fluid concept, and that throughout the course of a construction project, the acceptance will change from one party to another. So perhaps from a subcontractor to the general contractor to the owner. And that is the only case that I have. That's it.
Very good. Thanks a lot, Steve. Next up, Clara Margaret Gruber, head of our Construction Transactions Subcommittee.
This is Claire, and I have no report for this month, and I regret that, but watch the space for next.
It is what it is. Thanks, Claire Margaret. We appreciate you getting this subcommittee off the ground. Okay, next up, our Contractors University Initiative, headed up by our former chairs, Lee Weintraub and Carrie Wright. Lee and Carrie, anything you want to tell everyone?
This is Leon. I'm not sure.
I haven't heard from him yet.
Okay, good. Well, we had a conference call in December right before Christmas, and we are going to try to roll out the Contractors University in the fall of this year. We're going to have three locations, Fort Lauderdale, Tampa, and Orlando. We divided topics up that we thought will be of interest, and then we'll be reaching out to speakers. The purpose of the university is to target contractors in those areas. It may, you know, going to start out small, and they're intended to be 10 to 15 maybe attendees, contractors that will have presentations on substantive construction law, things that are practical to them, such as change orders, how to prepare claims, how to look at your insurance requirements, how to negotiate different contract provisions. And we're going to, again, split out in the fall, start small with three markets, and then next year, hopefully, you know, move to have one in Jacksonville and maybe one in the Panhandle, and we're going to have one in Atlanta as well. But the will be 2016 if the ones in 2015 are as successful as we think.
All right. Thanks, Kerry.
Sorry.
Next up, our Vice Chair Scott Pence and head of our Legislative Subcommittee. Scott, what's going on in the legislative world? Scott, you here? All right, no report from Scott today. Arnie Tritt, our immediate past chair and also head of our membership subcommittee, has sent emails alternatively stating that he would be here with a report or would not be here with a report. Arnie? All right, it's going to be not report, but he did send an email saying that we are up to had three new members, and we're now up to 625 members of the Florida Bar's Construction Law Committee. Publication, Sean Mickley.
Hey, Hardy, it's Sean here. Not much to report because of the holiday season, other than the fact that there's going to be an article published in Action Line, as we've discussed on a few occasions. No other articles right now to be reviewed or to be published. I'm still in the midst of trying to line up some subcommittees to prepare an article for publication in the following Action Line, so may have something more to report next month. And other than that, that's kind of where we stand in terms of publications at this point.
Very good. Thanks, Sean. If you have an interest in writing something or putting on a CLE program, you can talk to Angela Covington, who is our CLE chair for putting on a program. Neil, of course, is looking for stuff in construction litigation. And if you're going to speak about something, you might as well write something that Sean will help you get published somewhere, regardless of how long it is. So, all right, if you're, put us on mute too, if you would, but not hold. Don't overrun us with hold music. Next up, Lisa Colon Heron, our previous vice chair, regarding small business programs.
Hi, Hardy. How are you? I do have a written report that I did not get to send out before we started the meeting, but I will. I have a few cases to report on and some in the news items. The first case is out of Montana. It's a DBE challenge case. It's Mountain West Holdings versus the state of Montana, and this is a constitutional challenge to...
Hey, Lisa, hold on one second. Let me see if I can get somebody to mute us. Hey, if you can hear us, you got us on the line. Can you mute us and not put us on hold, please? I don't think we have much luck, Lisa. Why don't you just talk over them?
Okay, I'll do my best. Okay, this is a constitutional challenge to the state of Montana Department of Transportation DBE program. A contractor by the name of Mountain West Holding Company that performs traffic planning for the Department of Transportation sued the Department of Transportation and the state claiming that the DBE program as administered violates the 14th Amendment of the United States Constitution. The facts of the case is that the state of Montana has a DBE program because which each state has to have because they accept federal money for highway contracting. And Montana's program prior to 2005 was a race-conscious program, and subsequent to the course, the Ninth Circuit decision in Western States Paving Company switched to a race-neutral goal-setting method. Well, Weston, Mountain West Holding Company, the plaintiff in this case, said that even if that race-neutral means goal contracting was applied, it still was not able to get contracts, even though they had submitted, they were low bidders on at least two or three projects as a subcontractor, and they were not able to get the contract because of the DBE program. On a motion for summary judgment filed and briefed by both sides, the District Court of Montana upheld the DBE program, finding that the state had a disparity study done, which did show underutilization of several categories of minorities and several business categories. And the court found that that Mountain West did not put forth sufficient evidence to defeat or to raise an issue of material fact as to the validity of the disparity study done by the state of Montana. So that is the first case. And the second case is SBA size appeal out of the Office of Hearings and Appeal. And this is a size appeal that was filed by a company called MCH Corporation against a company called Synergy Solution. And this was an affiliation protest. Basically, MCH Corporation filed a size protest against Synergy, arguing that Synergy was affiliated with several companies because the owner of Synergy was the daughter of a company by the name of PAI, which was had subcontracted work in the past to Synergy, and the companies had shared a common office and had one-time common employees. Well, the MCH made an argument that because of that, Synergy and PAI was affiliated, and that the area office should have found affiliation because there was no clear fracture between the companies. At issue here was 13 CFR 121.103. Which provides that there can be found affiliation between two or more persons with a common identity of interest. The cases interpreting that provision creates a rebuttable presumption that close family members have identical interests and must be treated as one person. But the presumption can be rebutted by showing that there's a clear line of fracture between the family members. And the factors that are considered in the clear line of fracture argument is whether or not they share common offices, employees, facilities, and equipment, whether the firms have the same line of business, whether there's been financial assistance, such as loans or subcontracting between the firms. In this case, the Office of Hearing and Appeals found that although Synergy and PAI were presumed to have been affiliated based on a family relationship, that as of the date of determining Synergy size for the procurement, the company no longer had any dealings, so that it was a clear line of fracture as of the date of the procurement. And that is my report. I have one more. In the news, I'm reporting on a federal indictment against a small DBE, WBE company out of Chicago. A lady by the name of Elizabeth Perino was indicted a few weeks ago after a three-year investigation brought about by a whistleblower for her company. And the indictment alleges that she took part in a pass-through scam as a woman-owned business at the Chicago O'Hare International Airport, whereby her company was used to count towards the DBE and WBE goals on the project, but her company actually did no work, although it received 10% of the amounts billed to the project. And that's my report, Hardy.
Thank you very much, Lisa. Next up, Surety and Insurance. Bruce Partington and Ty Thompson are our co-chairs of this subcommittee. Do you all have something to share today?
Yes. Hi, Hardy. It's Ty Thompson. I don't know if Bruce is on the line or not. We don't have a substantive report today, but I am happy to announce that we have two new folks that are interested in being members, Lee Weintraub and Bennett Acuff, that will assist in ideas, reporting, and some prospective programming that we're going to suggest. We're in the process of coordinating a conference call for the end of this month. To the extent that anybody is interested in getting involved with the Surety and Insurance Subcommittee, please either shoot me or Bruce an email, and we'll be happy to get you signed up and participating. That's all I have.
All right. Thanks, Ty. Brent Zimmerman is our chair of our website subcommittee. Brent, what's going on with the website?
Well, just the website, just trying to keep it up to date and posting the meetings and the podcast and such and the materials for each of the meetings, and so we're trying to get that going forward. Other than that, to report.
Great. We're trying to get all of our things that we email out to everyone on the website, as well as attendance stuff, which reminds me, along with the agenda and that email is a link to record your attendance. We'll send that out and we'll post a link on the website where you can go and check the attendance. Sometimes folks can't remember when they're reporting CLE if they were here at a meeting or not, and we'll get that there as a service so people can look back on that. Tech subcommittee, nothing new. We're putting our podcasts up. Those are being downloaded and played more often, and I think we figured it out, so that's working. I got an email from Scott Pence, who couldn't make it with the legislative report. I'll just tell you all what's happening. We're continuing to monitor a bill regarding Chapter 558, House Bill 87, and working through some issues relating to Representative Corcoran's proposed changes to Chapter 713. And the real property section's got some special committee is proposing changes to priority of liens under 713.06. So those are the issues that we're involved in that are in play with the legislature. If that's a matter of concern to you, reach out to Scott Pence directly, and we'll keep everyone posted. Angela Covington is our CLE chair, and one of the things she does is coordinate speakers for each of our monthly meetings. Ken Goff will be speaking in March. Chris Cobb is speaking next month regarding design professional liability. And, of course, Elizabeth Ryan is going to speak today regarding e-discovery issues. Before we go on with that, let me just ask that you please email Angela Covington if you're interested in speaking in April or May or later regarding a topic. As Neil Sivier noted, the section is looking for people to present at webinars, which would be a little more substantial than what we do in our monthly meetings. Instead of being about 30 minutes, it would be about an hour. It would be through a professional webinar service, and there would be a charge for that. We'd like to support the bar and the section, and in addition to what we do monthly, put together 3 to 6 of those. So if you're interested in doing a more substantial ECLE, let us know. We can get you plugged in with that. Before we move on to our CLE presentation, any comments, suggestions, new business from anyone out there? All right. With that, what I will do is, Elizabeth, are you here with us?
I am.
Very good. Did Angela give you the leader pin rather than the regular participant one?
That's the one I dialed in, so hopefully it worked.
Hopefully it works. Okay. The idea is that I'm going to go ahead and mute everyone now. Let's see.
Conference is now in silent mode.
Okay. The idea now, Elizabeth, is that everyone's muted except you and me, and you will. I'm going to introduce you here, and we'll let you do your presentation. And then when you're done, I'll unmute everyone, and we'll see if anybody's got questions or comments or follow-up. So are you still there so I know when I hand it off you're there?
I am. Thank you. Can you hear me?
Yes, excellent. Well, thank you for joining us. Elizabeth, are you in the Tampa office of Cass Schuler?
I am.
So Elizabeth is with the Tampa office of Cass Schuler, and she's been with that office since July of 2002. She's a graduate of Northeastern University and Boston University for her law degree, is a member of both the Massachusetts Bar and the Florida Bar. She is a CEDS certified as an electronic discovery specialist. She specializes in complex commercial litigation and construction law, works on developing an e-discovery group at Cass Schuler, and has participated in a number of e-discovery conferences and is a frequent speaker on the topic. So we're happy to have Elizabeth here with us today and appreciate her for volunteering to do this. It's a very timely topic. So Elizabeth, take it over.
Thank you. And I'm very happy actually to be here today and have the opportunity to speak with you. One of the things that I've discovered in my various lectures is that there's a huge disparity between practitioners that know a great deal and are very sophisticated in this topic, and people who know absolutely nothing at all and are afraid to begin. One of the reasons for that is because the law is evolving rapidly. There's huge differences between federal law and Florida law and international law. There's different requirements at each stage. Transactional lawyers would have different requirements than people that are practicing in litigation. But the one constant is that lawyers are now responsible for clients' record keeping and production of documentation in a way that was never the case before. Because of this new obligation and because of the potential problems that could ensue if lawyers are afraid to start anything at all, I put together a package with what I've discovered is the most requested information. There's some steps that every practicing lawyer should be implementing to protect their clients. It doesn't really matter if they're in-house or in private, if they're transactional or litigators. They should be warning anybody who consults with them about the critical requirements of protecting their information, just as they would with a statute of limitations deadline. When I was preparing for a prior lecture, I fell upon an article that the ABA had in its solo practice section. It recommended including a reference to ESI preservation as early as an engagement letter. When I first read it, I paused and I thought about it, and I thought, that's a really good point. Wow, I should be doing that. I wonder who else is. And I inquired with my coworkers and my peers, and like me, nobody had. Nobody had considered it, and nobody was implementing this. And in fact, most of them asked me for samples. So at the presentation that I'd been preparing for, I again mentioned this recommendation to incorporate a litigation hold reference at engagement, and everybody looked up at me. I think they sort of had the same reaction that I had. So I provided in our materials for today one draft. I provided in our materials today the article that I had read, Engagement Letters Beginning a Beautiful Relationship. And in the back, you'll see, if you take a look at it, document and file retention, the reference that I was discussing and where I had seen this initially. And I also provided two example retainer letters, engagement letters. One is a version of my engagement letter that I use, and one is an example of the Lomas administrative form that the bar has on site. And I added into that one the references to maintaining documentation and recommending to a client to preserve it. And while I was putting this together, I thought, you know, like statute of limitations defenses, you may want to warn a client at the first consultation, even if they decide not to retain you or your firm decides not to represent them, and send out some kind of letter afterwards to protect yourself. So I drafted one example of that. That's number one. If my materials are numbered by the topic. So one would be the initial consultation letter. There's a couple of exhibits attached that are numbered two. That's the bar letter, the bar recommendation, and then the two sample letters. And because I'm asked so often for samples, I provided some litigation hold notices, and those are for your client, and also a preservation letter, which is the letter that goes out to third parties once you're representing somebody and you want them to preserve information. And the final attachment is a claim kit chart that Chris Cheatham has developed that I provide in all of my lectures. I think it's excellent. And this chart you can use at your initial consultation. It's a way to get started in your communications with your client when you're starting to discuss the lawsuit itself. And this is the perfect time at the very initial consultation to find out when you're finding out fact information from your client, your potential client. What happened, when did it happen, who has information, are there documents. This is the time to start asking, what kinds of electronically stored information do you have? and what are you doing to protect it? And who are the people that are responsible for that? And do you have a document retention program in place? And these kinds of questions can be complicated and complex, and this chart does a good job of summarizing it and kind of taking you through it. But really the most important thing is that it starts the two most critical pieces of a lawyer's role in electronic discovery, and that is communication and documentation. You want to start with your very first conversation with your potential client, communicating to them the importance of preserving their information, and you want to start with the very first consultation documenting that you've told them that and documenting the information that they've given you. It's important to remember that most of, while just like the lawyer's responsibility for helping the client preserve information is new, likewise, it's new to remember that most of the steps undertaken in that are not protected by attorney-client privilege. So you'll want to document these steps that you take. You'll want to communicate these responsibilities in a manner that you don't mind producing, because if there's a problem later, you may well be asked to do that. And it's likely that you will be required to at some point. Communication and documentation are really important, and they're really important because they'll probably be discoverable. So use the claim kit. Use the claim kit and in your initial consultation when you're asking the questions with your very first meeting, and then follow up that very first meeting with some version of your own of this post-meeting letter. And in that post-meeting letter, remind the client, that potential client, that you discussed this, that it is their duty to hold on to this information. Once you decide to memorialize that relationship, if both parties decide to engage in representation, remind the client again in the engagement letter. Whatever version you want to have for your engagement letter, add in there that it's critical, that it's critical to remind you of your duty to preserve and retain any and all documents. And my version spells out some examples of that. Your particular situation may require more or less. And you also identify in your engagement letter that a litigation hold notice will be coming afterwards with more details, but that they are required and it's their responsibility to implement a preservation plan, and that if they don't, that they could be liable for the loss of that information. Then, again, like I said before, I have some examples here of litigation hold notices. Interestingly, some of these do say attorney-client privileged and attorney work product on them. These are examples that I've gathered from various locations. Some I've used and some other people have served on our clients, and my assistant just retyped them and redacted them. So one of the important things to remember about a litigation hold notice is it's very, very important that it be tailored to your relationship, to your client, to the types of information and the custodians that are involved. One of the problems that has been encountered is that even an attorney doing a great job in making sure that they send out a litigation hold notice, those notices have been challenged. They've either been challenged as being not sufficient or of being overbroad. You don't want to use just some standard form letter and use it over and over and over again in every situation. The litigation hold notice, is likely discoverable, so you don't want it to contain information that you don't want somebody else to see that breaches the rest of your attorney-client privilege relationship with your client. And you don't want to send it to everybody in the business. Now, if it's a small business with three people, that's different than if it's an enormous company with thousands of employees. But during your initial consultation, you're going to be finding out using your little claim kit chart and going through your fact-finding process who it is that has information, who the IT people are, who are the key employees, and who runs this company, who's the one that would have the most information, and then going down from there. One of the questions that you're going to get answers to when you start sending out these litigation hold notices and you do your follow-up is who else has information. And it's at that point that you can start sending more and more and more out. And this is an iterative process. You'll send out some type of summary on what needs to be done and how to prevent it, and then you're going to follow up and get more information and send out more and follow up and get more information and send out more. And all this time, you're going to do the two most important things the communication and the documentation with the clients. You're going to stay in touch with the IT department through the representative that's been designated to assist you. You're going to let them know, this is the information that I've discovered. Is there any place else that it could be stored? Here are some of the places. What are you doing to back it up? You know, are there more people that you know of that have this information inside this company? Where do they use laptops? Do they use cell phones? You know, these types of devices can hold lots of information. Have a personal telephone conversation with each of the custodians that you learn about. And I don't want to get off on a complex topic today, complex discussion about how to collect and how to produce. Those are entire days and more of information. But these initial steps, the initial communications and the initial stages of documentation and gathering information are things that every lawyer should be doing, every lawyer at all, no matter what you practice, should be doing these things to protect their clients and to protect themselves. And each step should be well documented and well communicated to the client. Each step should be an information gathering piece. And hopefully, if you have any questions, please feel free to get in touch with me. We can talk in private about more detailed things. Hopefully this is helpful. This is the stuff that everybody is asking for, or samples. So thank you very much. Is anybody there?
Hold on 1 second, Elizabeth. Let me get it unmuted, all right?
Sure.
I just want to make sure I press the right button. Sorry about that.
Conference is now in talk mode.
Very good. All right, Elizabeth. We've got everybody unmuted. Anyone with any questions or comments on eDiscovery?
I think the letters are the most helpful part of the whole thing.
Yeah. All right. First, can anyone that out there just say hello so I know we've got everyone unmuted?
Hi, Marty. It's Giselle. Good morning.
Okay.
I have a question. I hope it's not too technical or complex, but this is very interesting. If the speaker, Elizabeth, if you could comment a little bit on large corporations that have subsidiaries and wholly owned subsidiaries. I mean, I don't want to get off into a tangent, but could you touch on that briefly because you're so experienced with this?
Okay. First of all, that raises a whole bunch of points. Since we're on the phone with the construction law section, on that point, although a little bit off of subject, you know, sureties have agencies. And one of the cases that I think it was this year, it could have been last year, but one of the more recent cases is that a surety is responsible for its agents' communications and information. So, okay, now back to yours. My recommendation would be, and it would depend on the structures, when you're having your conversation with your initial client, you know, your discussion about who could potentially have information, you want to find out the structure of the companies. And if there are subsidiaries and if there are sister corporations and agencies and other entities that may be involved in this chain of a relationship with the opposing parties, immediately find out who it is in there that is responsible for providing information. That is the person you're talking to also on, you know, a principal in those subsidiaries, or do you need somebody else? And what kinds of information is moving around amongst them? I would strongly suggest that everybody be warned not to delete information, no matter if there's even a remote possibility that there's something there. And practitioners should remember to ask that question. It's actually a really good question. Because if the company is enormous and there are many subsidiaries, and the laws, the problem is that if there's one overseas, the laws are different there. I mean, this is an extremely complex question.
Yeah, thank you.
Of course, I'm happy to discuss it with you in more detail, you know, off this conference, you know, since it's
certainly.
Okay.
I know it's complex, and that's why I cautioned and said it might be too complex for this call, but thank you for the brief answer. Thank you.
Sure. Anybody else?
You didn't know we'd have background music for you, did you, Elizabeth?
I like it. I don't have mine on, so it's, you know, it's helpful. Calming.
Yeah. All right. Anyone else? Anything on eDiscovery? With that, we will wrap it up with the soothing sounds of I don't know who that is. So everyone, have a great month. Talk to you second Monday in February.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Thank you.
Thanks, Elizabeth.
Bye. Bye.